Okay, welcome to the Circle for Presence. And I always want to say, and my name's Karen. And one time when I did that a couple of months ago, somebody said, duh. Okay, but you know, I just have it. Okay. I'm just amazed. I expected with this first day of really a summer for us that maybe two or three people would show up and then everybody would be down at the river. So this is awesome. Okay, I would like to start with talking about, well, let me check first so that I'm not repeating stuff that I don't need to repeat. Is there anybody in here that would like to have some tips about how to go into silent meditation? Everybody pretty much know how to work with that? Because what I do is that So, thanks, Corey. So, basically, there's three ways that I teach that you can play with to find out what's going to work with you. They are not the only three ways. There's lots of ways that you can play with this. And find out what you're comfortable with, what works best for you. So one of the ways that I do it is that I get focused on my breathing and just really pay attention to the breath. And what I'll do is kind of use a mantra in my head of the words inhale and exhale, saying them in my mind as I'm inhaling and exhaling. At the same time, kind of paying attention to my abdomen, because one of the things we don't do very well is breathe. You know, it's really underrated. So, you know, and especially us women, because we get taught we're supposed to have these nice flat tummies, and so we begin to learn how to breathe from up here in our chest, and we don't get enough oxygen. We really don't. So what I would like you to practice while you do this is to just check in and see, are you breathing deep enough? Are you breathing down here? So the inhale, exhale. That's one way. If that's not working, continue breathing. Check in with your senses. Now, the first one that I will do is an open eye meditation, and I just look at color, size, texture, shape. But you don't want to start labeling, like, oh, that wall's dirty, somebody needs to clean that. Because now we got the voice of the ego going, and the mind is going to jump in, and it's going to do its yappity yap every chance it gets. Well, I should say mind does. So if that begins to happen, I just close my eyes, and I get real focused on listening, and I pay attention to what I'm hearing, and you'll begin to hear levels of sound. At first it'll sound really quiet, and then you'll start noticing some sound, and then as it gets quieter and quieter, and I mean this, your mind, as it gets quieter, you'll notice another level of sound that you don't have any awareness of at all when we're going about our normal stuff and this is talking to us the whole time. Okay? And then check in with the other senses as well. You can see what it is you're smelling, you know, odor, fragrance. What is your skin feeling? You know, how does it feel to sit in the chair, you know, or a lot of people like to be on the floor. So just check in with your body, see how you feel. That's what being grounded means, by the way. It means getting into your body, being in your body, out of your head. Okay, so you can use the five senses, sort of check in, as long as you're not naming and labeling stuff. And if that doesn't work, then pretend you're a cat at a mouse hole, waiting for the mouse to come out. Only what you're waiting for is the next thought. And that works for me every time. Okay, so give those a try, play around with them. We do it for about 15 minutes. And I start us with the crystal bowl that's attuned to the crown chakra. And so for those of you that aren't familiar with the chakras, the crown chakra is right back there. And it is our connection to divine source. And sit wherever you want to sit. Do whatever you've got to do to be comfortable for this, okay? Here we go. One of the things that I had also meant to share that I always, for some reason, just forget to share about meditation is that it's not about checking out. One of the things that is practiced in Zen monasteries is that as the guys are all in meditation, only they do it for way longer than 15 minutes. They're going for hours. That one of the things that the master is doing is walking around with a bamboo cane and just hauling off and smacking the back of, you know, indiscriminately whoever he feels like doing that with. Because the purpose is that if you are in pure awareness and totally present, which is what the silent meditation is meant to do, then he knows who is in that space, because as he is ready to hit them, they reach back and grab the cane. Even though their eyes are closed, he's been walking around because they're totally aware. Think about a cat. You know, I use that pretend you're a cat at a mouse hole waiting for the next mouse, and you were going to wait for the next slot. Have you ever watched a cat sit and be focused on something? They notice everything because you can watch their ears. You know, you can make a sound, and the ears will go kind of in that direction. But they don't look. The tail might twitch a little. But they are, you know, they're totally focused. I mean, that's why I say that my cats are my best teachers for presence that there is. Because I can watch them, and they don't get distracted. You know, but they are totally aware. Absolutely totally aware. So what I was going to continue with today, because last week's subject was rather large, wouldn't you say? And it was the pain and anger caused by expectations. For those of you who look for the recordings on my website or on iTunes, we were trying something new last week and it didn't work out very well, and so I chose not to put it on there because it was just like way irritating and a lot of it dropped out and you couldn't hear. And I have since ended up purchasing more equipment because I talked to somebody that actually knew what the hell they were talking about. Yeah, he was a DJ and he knew sound equipment and stuff and knew exactly what the problem was and what I had to do. So we're all good to go now. So that's good. But what we talked about last week were a lot of the expectations that we have of other people. And we talked about sort of that social grease, even when we think somebody should have manners. They should be, you know, like, well, he was rude, or she wasn't very polite, or that wasn't very courteous. And I had used the example of, like, I had been raised that if an elder person and I were walking up to a door about the same time, they were older than me, even if they were only a few years older than me, I was to open the door for them and let them pass through. And men get taught this, especially with women of all ages, that that's just the mandatory kind of thing. So I had used the example of going to the store and this young man walking in front of me opened the door and just let it almost slam in my face, and the reaction that I had inside and how I carried that through my whole grocery shopping experience, you know, how rude he was, and my gosh, didn't anybody teach him right, and, you know, and was moving it, I was trying to move it towards compassion by, okay, well, he wasn't taught, you know, Karen, some people just aren't taught. And it literally began to amaze me where the ego, the mind, went in dealing with that the whole time, not being present at all. I mean, I was no more present doing my grocery shopping than flying to the moon. You know? One of the things that is a really good way to find out when you're present, have you ever driven somewhere, a place that you, like say work, and you literally can't remember the drive from when you left home to when you got there?
You weren't present.
That's a clue. Okay? But also, we do get caught in the trap of knowing what was going on. Oh, yeah, I talked to so-and-so. Yeah, I saw this. Yeah, I did that, da-da. So we think we're present. And we're not. We're not in our bodies. We're up in our heads. We're operating from the head. I don't know about you guys, so I'll speak only for myself. The voice of the ego for me is constantly labeling, judging, putting in a box, doing something. You know, it needs order. It needs organization. It needs everything to make sense to it. And if it doesn't make sense, it'll make it make sense, even if it has to condemn it. Okay? So, just for those of you that are maybe not as familiar with these, ego, mind, what else do I use? Yeah, thinking. Thank you. Those are the three that when I'm using those, and I'll bounce all around, but I'll use these three different words that all are meaning the same thing to me, just so that you know and we're on the same page. And ego is not the Western psychology term of ego. For those of you familiar with that stuff, it doesn't have anything to do with that. I mean, well, it does, but that's for another day, and that's a long topic. But bottom line is, what we're using it for here is the voice in your head. So to help folks get in touch with what I mean by that is, if you, how many people in here have experienced what you'd call maybe melancholy? Not quite depression, but melancholy, right? Okay. Now I want you to answer to yourself these questions. Did you notice that you were feeling that way when you were at work? Did you notice you were feeling that way when you were planning a meal or getting dressed or taking a shower or doing any other of your normal sort of routine activities? If you answered yes to any of those questions, what I would ask you then is, who noticed? Who noticed what you were feeling? That's the essence of who you are. That's the pure I am presence that is not this. It is not ego, it's not the mind, it's not our thinking. We, you know, and I don't believe it's just us in the United States. I believe that globally we have become compulsive, addictive thinkers. And that we're operating out of our heads most of the time. And I hear a lot of people talk about how they get a concept or they understand something, but they just can't quite get it into their life, or they can't quite integrate it, right? And they'll talk about, I can't get that connection down here, and, you know, whether it's a head-to-heart connection or head-to-gut connection. Bottom line is, it's because we have lived up here so long, we don't know how to get down into our heart centers. And you have to drop down into your heart center, one, to manifest, for one thing. So if you're trying to change something in your life, if you're trying to change what's going on in your relationship, whether it's with your spouse, your partner, your kids, your boss, your coworkers, it really doesn't matter, because those are all relationships. The intimate romantic one's the most powerful one. And I talked last week about how we always think that getting into those relationships are all about, you know, finding happy ever after, right? No, we get into relationships because what we get to experience through our partners is we get to come to know ourselves. We project onto them all the stuff we can't see in us because we've judged it as bad. So that's one of the reasons why I talk about get out of good, bad, right, wrong. Because as long as I'm judging those kinds of things bad, I'm certainly not going to be able to see them in myself. I'm not going to want to see them. And denial is powerful. And a lot of people think, well, I'm not in denial. How do you know? When I'm in denial, I don't even, you know, somebody told me a long time ago, it was an acronym, D-E-N-I-A-L. Don't even know I am lying. And that's true, because the things that I was in denial about, I had no idea that I couldn't see. And that's what we call awarenesses, or even the bigger ones, epiphanies, when we go, oh, wow. Or we get those moments of clarity where what happens is we get to experience a clear vision of what we're doing, or what we're about, or what's happening in a certain relationship of our life. So from that, what we experience is, if I'm, you know, in the past, I was really quick at judging that stuff, and it was like, oh, God, Karen, really? This is awful. I mean, you know, and I would beat myself up. And sometimes I was even successful at getting it pushed right back down. So it didn't change. I felt better. Well, the ego felt better. But it didn't change. And then I wondered why I still struggled with the issues of whatever it was I was looking at, working on, or why I was struggling in my relationship, or why I was struggling with communicating with my son, or why I was struggling with, you know, any number of things, making more money, being happier with my work, blah, 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 and it goes on, right? Okay, so one of the things that you can start with doing is taking a look at your judgments. When I look at what my expectations are, a lot of them embarrassed me. Well, embarrassment, you're going to love this, all your ego feels embarrassed. The I Am Presence has no judgment on it, so there's no embarrassment. We feel embarrassed because what? We experience that that's not a good thing, that's a bad thing, so I don't want anybody to know that. Embarrassment is like public shame. Okay? It's like the time that I was, oh, I love, this is a good example. I'll use an example of something I've already done so that I don't manifest like I did last time with getting stuck in the mud. So I was working at Providence Medical Center, and I had helped put that treatment center together. And we had opened, and it was, you know, just a big deal. And this was back in the day when treatment centers were, there was a whole lot different feel to it. This was back in 1984. So, and I'm all dressed up, you know, and I'm greeting people. And I go down to where we had opened up this huge area and had these teak folding doors, you know, so that we could literally create three separate rooms if we wanted to. And when I was down there, there were a few people that were talking that had said they were people that were going to actually check themselves in and become patients and go through treatment. They were just really impressed with everybody they had talked to. They recognized they had a problem. I thought that was kind of amazing. I mean, when I drank, that's the last thing I was going to do is show up at the opening of a treatment center. But hey, we all have our different paths getting there, right? So I chatted with them for a little bit, and I'm still feeling like, you know, I just am all that in a bag of chips. And so I go into the restroom. When I come out of the restroom, I'm still doing that strut, you know, that walking, you know, a little misconfident here, and I'm trailing about 3 feet of toilet paper that has hooked itself to the heel of my high heel across the room, and somebody's kind of snickering, and I looked and laughed, and yeah. And it wasn't until I was out of the room that I felt something as I turned, and I went, and here came the embarrassment, right? Okay, so public shame. But what that was the ego. Oh, you dummy, it was the ego that was prancing and thinking she was all that in a bag of chips. And it's the ego going, oh, you didn't look so hot in there trailing 6 feet of toilet paper behind you. So those kinds of emotions, I had a teacher one time tell me that guilt, for example, was incredibly narcissistic. That it really is, if you look at what guilt is, it's all about me, me, me. Even though it's in the negative, you know, somehow we've made that okay. That what I don't accept, or what our culture says isn't okay, is to say, look how wonderful and magnificent I am. But it's okay to beat myself up and feel guilty for those things that I didn't do correctly, right? Again, more expectations. I'm going to get into that. So taking a look at embarrassment, taking a look at guilt as emotions from the ego. All that stuff stems out of fear. So, in fact, I operate literally from believing that everything, all emotions, will boil down to two. Love or fear. Okay? Fear is what the ego produces. And why I do the work of Byron Katie so much is because that really questions those thoughts that create our anxieties, that create our hurt, that create all that fear and all that guilt and embarrassment and shame and all that stuff, and kind of blows it wide open. I mean, we look at it again and we go, oh. I talked with I don't know how many people on the phone this weekend, and forgiveness kept being this issue that kept popping up. I put it out on Facebook even, because it just really had me thinking about it, that if I have trouble forgiving somebody, that what's happening is I am looking at you and deciding what you have done or said or not done or not said is a bad thing, and I'm holding this against you. And energetically, that comes out of the heart chakra. That's where we hold resentments, and it's the heart chakra where we forgive. Okay? So if you hang on to resentments and don't forgive and stay in that judgment place with somebody or a situation or whatever it might be, long enough, eventually our physical body pays for it. Usually through heart disease, which we squeeze the joy right out of our life. So we end up with some sort of heart problem, or we can end up with a lung problem, a breathing problem. So in looking at forgiveness, what I do is that I will write what I call a poison pen letter. Dear John, you SOB. And I just write it out. I don't edit it. I don't try to sound all fluffy and spiritual, all recovered. You know, I throw that out the window and I listen to what's actually going on up here. I don't put on paper what I think I should be feeling or thinking or behaving like, because that's not going to get me the result I'm looking for. Okay, so I write this poison pen letter, and I just put out everything I think about them, about the situation, about whatever, okay, whatever comes to mind. And you can always tell, if you've ever done this, you can always tell when you're at the end of a letter, because you almost feel spent. So there's a certain amount of energy that gets released in that process. And then I go through and I pull out the major thoughts. I start with those first, and I take them through Byron Katie's four questions, so that what I get to experience is that if I am the projector and everybody and everything in my world is what I'm projecting, then what I'm seeing in them is actually a mirrored reflection of my shadow that I can't see. And when I can see that through those questions and the answers and the turnarounds, what happens for me is that I don't even need to ask myself at that point, do I need to forgive this person? Because forgiveness just happens. It's instant. I can feel it. My whole body shifts. The whole way I look at them, the situation, everything is changed. So for any of you that are looking for quick fix stuff, in a way, I would recommend her work. Now, it's not quick fix in that, you know, you do it a couple of times and you're done and you're awakened and enlightened. Well, if it works for you that way, you can start teaching, because I would be absolutely amazed. That's not been my experience, nor my experience with anybody else. But it's a simple process that if I'm willing to sit down with pen to paper and slow myself down, you can't answer it just off the top of your head. You can't just answer the questions off the top of your head, because the ego is going to answer. The mind jumps in there and goes, yes, no, yeah, okay, I feel a little frustrated, yeah, I'd be more peaceful, okay, yada, yada. I mean, the ego's just like, God, okay, this is about boring, you know, can we move on, please? Isn't there a good movie on? You know, so it's going to come up with other stuff, but when I make myself sit down with pen to paper, and in the beginning, I did it with someone else. I had someone else help facilitate me through it, so that I could learn the process. And that's what it is. Because within a half an hour, I swear to God, and that's quick, I can take something that has been a belief driving my anxiety through the roof for years, and it just dissipates. And it doesn't come back. Even when the thought will wander back through, it's just like, oh, okay, and it doesn't hang around. She refers to it as, if you can realize, well, what she talks about it is like being out in the desert and you're scared to death of snakes. So you're out hiking in the desert and you come across a great big Mojave rattler. And he's rattling and his head's up and he's ready to strike, and you're close enough and you're frozen because you're so scared of snakes to begin with. The cloud shifts and it's a rope caught on a branch. Now, she says, I dare you to stand over that thing for 1,000 years and try to convince yourself again that it's a snake. But once you've seen it's a rope hung up on a branch, you're never going to be able to believe again that it's a snake. So that's what happens with these thoughts. So, okay, set that aside. I'm putting the recipe together here. I can see it. Okay, so back to expectations. The flip side that I wanted to work on this week, and I'm going to pull those components in that we just talked about, is the expectations that other people have of us. The expectations that people have about how we're to behave, right? And those are for all kinds of roles. The role of wife or husband or partner, the role of brother or sister, the role of daughter or son, the role of grandparent, the role of neighbor, friend, and maybe even your job, depending on what your job is. That if you have a certain job, there's a certain set of expectations about how you're to behave. I notice a lot of times people have certain expectations that because I teach this and I've been working at this for so long that, you know, I'm next in line to be Buddha or something. And I'm here to tell you, some of you are probably ahead of me. You know, we teach what we most need to learn, and I believe that, you know. So for people to have expectations of how I'm to be, a lot of times they're going to get disappointed, aren't they? But take a look at the more personal roles. Take a look at the roles as you as a parent, you as a grandparent, you as a daughter or a son or a partner. And the expectation that you have felt from that other person as to how you were supposed to just respond in a certain way, and yet you didn't have a clue because that wasn't the way you were thinking. That wasn't your perception of that particular relationship or that role. So, for example, grandparents are supposed to be all loving, volunteering, there all the time, right? I don't know how many of you in here are grandparents, but I'm one, and that doesn't work for me. I have a pretty full life. So a whole different set of things had to get worked out for how I was going to be a grandmother. Because that was going to be a different experience. Number one, for me, obviously, I had never been one before. The grandmothers I had were actually... they were both immigrants. One was from Czechoslovakia and one was from Scotland. Now, I'm not Czech or Scottish. I was adopted into the family, just letting you know. That would have been a better combination. But what happened was, I saw that, I mean, they were the quintessential grandmothers, right? I mean, they both even had little wire-rimmed glasses, and they had white hair that they had up in a bun, and, you know, they wore long dresses, and my mother's mother, grandma down in Oregon, she had those stockings that, you know, that they rolled here. Well, you didn't see those because her dress came down to here. She always wore a dress. I don't care if she was working in the yard, milking the cow. Yeah, I mean, she lived on a farm, but she wore her dress. And so I didn't really have any role models, right? And yet at the same time, there were expectations of how I was supposed to behave and what was expected of me, even though I wasn't even given a script. Ever experienced that? Somebody got pissed off at you because you weren't behaving in whatever role that was? And you're sitting there totally baffled because you're going, wait a minute. I'm supposed to do what? And they never even communicated it to you. So, how do you react to that? That's one of the ways to also look at your expectations. Because what I was able to recognize that even in that situation where there were expectations on me that were uncommunicated, I reacted and got furious because I had expectations that these are young adults. They would communicate with me and we'd negotiate. What was the problem? Excuse me? So I got angry because my expectations of them. You see how it just, it's like a ping pong game. It just goes back and forth. And none of us ever, at least I never, took the time to sit down and pull apart what has happened here. What's really gone on here? And bottom line is, every time, it was always about the ego. Have you ever gotten into an argument with somebody and it felt so intense to you that it almost felt like there was a part of you that saw it as a fight to the death. There wasn't any cost too high to prove you were right. That's the ego. That's your first clue that that's the ego. Because the ego will fight to the death. It sees every... If you are saying to me that I am wrong, to accept being wrong, I mean, to say that, I screwed up. I made a mistake. I wished I hadn't done that. I don't feel good about what I did. I'm going to step into that a minute too, but... That's all about the ego wanting to survive, because it believes if it says it's wrong, it's going to die. It's annihilated. I mean, what is there to... I mean, that moves you right into present moment. Okay, for those of you that have been able to look at something... Now, and this is where I said I'll talk about that in a moment. Apologizing or admitting you've made a mistake and you've done something that wasn't comfortable to you. That's an important little phrase I want you to hear. Wasn't comfortable to you. I will not apologize to somebody just because they think I've done something wrong. Because those are those little white lies that we tell for love, approval, and appreciation. I don't want you mad at me. I don't want to have this intensity going on between us. I want us to get along, you know. I just want us to be happy. I just want peace, you know. So we apologize and we don't mean it. So chances are, am I going to do it again? Yeah. Okay. So I really, really would implore you to look at when you're apologizing, before you open your mouth and go there, ask yourself, were you comfortable with the way things went down? Are you truly saying that what you did, that you're okay with it? You're comfortable in your skin? Because if you are, you are. Period. There's no judgment about it. If you are, you are. So, bottom line is, if you go ahead and apologize, you've now, let's say it's a big thing. Let's go for something. Sometimes I can make up good stuff on the spot and sometimes I can't. Let's say you borrowed a friend's car and you returned it and didn't, and you used a half a tank of gas and you didn't put more gas in it. And they're saying, you owe me some money because I gave you the car with a full tank and you bought it back with a half tank. And if you honestly think, and this is possible, let's say it's the kind of friendship that you guys have for years, gone back and forth, using each other's stuff, and money really never has exchanged hands. You've been friends for, say, 20 years, and that's just what's happened, right? You've borrowed clothes with each other, you've exchanged cars, you babysat for each other, whatever, okay? So, in your mind, you wouldn't put gas in the car. But how many people would back up and without even thinking, without even considering, all based on what the other person is saying, oh, I am so sorry, I'll put gas in it. Or they go to the other extreme and get defensive and argue, when have we ever exchanged money? You borrowed my car, you know, 10 years ago, do you remember? And you drove it all over, and I even had to get the brakes fixed and put oil change in it, and you were the one driving it most of the time. You know, because all of a sudden now our memories get really good. Mine does. You've got to pull it back. Mine does. That's my experience. Okay, so that's where I would suggest before you jump in and apologize, or even before you jump in and defend, because it's still the ego. The ego is going to prove it's right and it's going to fight to the death. So this could be a relationship, a friendship that's been going on for 20 years that now, what? Totally falls apart. And someone who's always been there for you, someone that you've always been there for, now all of a sudden can't stand sight of each other. And it's because ego went up against ego. Now it would be different if you came to me and asked to borrow my car, and I'd say, yeah, sure, I'm tight with money, so I've been budgeting my gas, so if you could help me out a little with the gas, that would be great. I've put my expectation up front. I've communicated it. And then you can decide, well, I don't really have any money, that's why I was hoping I could borrow your car. You know, so we might sit down and do some more negotiating. But you see how being upfront and honest about it would prevent a whole lot of stuff. It would prevent the ego from going off and defending itself. But when I do that, when I let you know what my expectation is, I'm in present moment. I'm right here, right now. And the ego can't stand that. The ego has to be in past or has to be in future, even if it's just seconds ago or seconds from now, because it cannot exist in this moment. Okay, so expectations that others have of you. Think for a moment, each one of you, just think about maybe something in the last 6 months where you've kind of run up against that, whether it was your job, you know, who you are at your job, and so people just had that expectation, or your parents, or your kids, neighbor. Because some neighbors, you know, have expectations of what neighbors should do and be. I've experienced that. So take a look at that, and what I would invite you to do is kind of explore how might it be different if you were to assume the other person can't read your mind. The other person has no idea what your expectations are, and the other person probably also, I'm going to throw this little assumption in, is assuming that you believe the same thing they do. So they're going to be full of expectations, whatever they might be. Okay? So how might it look if you were to say, just very honestly, first you got to check in with yourself, right? Find out what's going on with you. And then that's where some people say, but I don't know that I could ask for money from my friend. I mean, that's kind of, that makes me seem selfish. Really? Let's question that belief. All of these beliefs need to be questioned. Every one of them. Every one of them. I have several people that I've been working, several students I've been working with lately that I keep getting the same thing from, but when I set boundaries, I feel like a bitch. Okay, so I guess we have some work to do. Because that's a belief that's going to prevent them from setting a simple boundary, which in another way of looking at it is an expectation. That boundary might be, don't talk to me in that tone of voice. If you talk to me in that tone of voice, I end up feeling scared. And as a result, I will remove myself. I will get my keys and I'll leave. Or I will hang up. I won't listen to abuse anymore. So if I'm not willing to go there and I just have this expectation that this person who maybe has even shown me a history of being verbally abusive, demanding, angry, throws temper tantrums to get his or her way, calls names, takes your inventory. So to avoid, what do you find yourself doing? A lot of people find themselves going along. They call it go along to get along. That's the social grease I was talking about. Okay? Social grease is totally out to lunch, and it is totally about the ego. It doesn't allow intimacy. It doesn't allow the authentic me to show up and be with the authentic you. It just doesn't. So I had a question last week. Well, you can't have people just doing whatever they want to do, whenever they want to do it, like, you know, running naked through the neighborhood. Why not? Now, obviously, this is where I think this gets so silly, because I think every one of you in here are intelligent, fairly clear-minded adults, and you know the consequences of a lot of behaviors. And so I don't have to be afraid of something or be held back by people telling me what I can and can't do, because I know that running through the streets naked is probably going to end me up in jail. So I'm going to have to deal with that. Yeah. But bottom line is, that's a consequence. So you guys look at consequences all the time and base decisions on those consequences. Right? So it's not about, no, we're not going to wreak havoc on the world when people are allowed to just be who they are. Because people, when given the opportunity to be in touch with their intuition, be in touch with their authentic selves, I've witnessed it over and over and over, and this time not just with myself, that people tend to choose healthy, positive, life-serving choices. So it truly then becomes about, who are we controlling? Sometimes I think what we're doing is really controlling ourselves through everybody else. Because there's that ego again, and it wants everything in nice, neat little boxes, and it wants it all organized and categorized, and the drawers shut, and the top dusted off, and flowers on top. You know? So, if I am willing to look at something that doesn't fit that, for example, well-tended, well-groomed, and meticulously manicured landscapes. The mind, the ego, loves those. There's symmetry, there's balance, everything's right where it's supposed to be, there's no dead leaves, they've been all picked off, everything's been deadheaded. You know, it's perfect. So the mind, the ego, can relax. It enjoys that. This is beautiful. And it goes out in the woods, or even worse yet, see somebody backyard that the roadies aren't deadheaded. There's weeds amongst flowers, or what are called weeds. Things are not trimmed and orderly and dialed in just right. So the ego can't relax. The ego's going nuts. The ego's sitting there going, oh, that would look better if that was trimmed up that way. That'd be beautiful. Boy, the potential here is just phenomenal. Ever done that? I know I have. So, it's in every area of our life. There is no area of our life that's left untouched by expectations, by wanting to put things in those nice, neat little boxes. Expectations that others have of us, and then as a result, look at the expectations we have of them of not having been, you know, they weren't supposed to behave that way. They weren't supposed to have expectations of me that they didn't communicate to me clearly and ask me, which would have been the respectful thing to do, for crying out loud. That was an expectation on my part. And so all the pain and the anger and the frustration that I experienced was I was focused on their expectations, and yet the pain and all that frustration and everything else that came with it was based on my expectations of them, not having those expectations. So I know that sounds a little nuts, but I think we are. You know, even though I said earlier that we're all intelligent, you know, healthy adults here, I do believe that. But I believe this is absolutely stark raving mad. it's out for itself, even when it's appearing to be in service for someone else. I'm just doing it to help them. I just want them to be okay. I'm doing it for her own good. He doesn't realize how much better he'd feel if he just did this. You know? How about maybe they're doing what they're doing because right now that's absolutely perfect for them, regardless of what it is. Absolutely regardless of what it is. That everything really is as it's supposed to be. That's a scary thought. Because then everybody starts thinking about, yeah, but what about the wars and the poverty and the horrible things that human beings do to other human beings and animals and, you know, oh God, the list is endless, and we go on and on and on, and then there are those that love to get on the political bandwagon and go off on their tangents. So, see, one of the other things I would invite you all to do is to question, really question, sit down and ask, what am I putting into this every day? Through the media, listening to the radio, reading the newspaper, reading magazines, watching television, watching the news, listening to the news. Somebody asked me, I think it was last night, what I thought of somebody's verdict that came in. And I didn't even know what the hell they were talking about, because I don't watch, listen, or read any media. And she was like, are you kidding? Really? You don't? Well, how do you stay up on things? And I need to stay up on things. Why? I mean, what you just told me about this person and a child being murdered sounds absolutely horrific. And I know that how I would respond as a mother and as a grandmother, besides just being a compassionate human being, and children are, you know, innocent, dependent little critters. They need us to protect them and take care of them, not harm them. So I know how I would react. Is there anything I can do about it? Anything? No. All it would do is cause my anxiety level to go up. And what most people don't realize, I love it when people say, oh, but I don't have any anxiety. I've never had panic attacks. Okay, you don't have to have a panic attack to have anxiety. If you've ever experienced depression, depression is anxiety-based. That's the foundation of it. Okay? And most of us, I'm going to say all of us with the exception of about maybe 4 people on the planet. Well, no. I suppose in those Zen monasteries, those guys just, yeah, they might not have any idea what anxiety is, so we'll give that to them. But I really believe that it's this background noise going on all the time, and we have adapted to it because it began in our childhoods. So, and if you came from Ozzy and Harriet, white bread, everything was perfect at home, one, I probably won't believe you, but two, if it's true, okay, but you went to school somewhere, public or private, I don't care which. There were expectations, there were people that were not healthy, there were people that crossed boundaries, that were disrespectful, and that were harmful in their words or the way they talked, blah, 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 blah. So, that's where that anxiety begins to raise. Playing out on the playground with other kids. The expectations that start there. The little ego starts to develop. You know? Wow. She was just playing and having a good old time until a bunch of the kids saw her doing flips on the monkey bars, and they thought, oh my God, that's awesome. Look at her go. And the ego popped up and went, wow. So now she starts doing stuff and looks around and makes sure people are watching. The intention is completely different. And that's where also where anxiety comes up. Because now she's got to top herself. And what happens when all the kids get disinterested like kids do, and they wander off to go do their own thing, and now nobody's watching? there's that anxiety. And that anxiety is the ego. So, okay, I want to stop there because I want to throw it open for comments or questions. And Matt, right there. And I just ask you to wait for the mic so that, because the students that I have elsewhere in the country, when they listen to these, they were listening to me talking out of context at this point. So they complained. On. No, no, you don't. No, new equipment. No, new equipment. It's all good now, Matt.
So I have two things to ask. One is, you said the base of depression is anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And I've struggled with depression a long time. Mm-hmm. And somebody once told me that depression is unexpressed anger turned inward,
mm-hmm.
which goes to what you said about
anxiety and fear. Yeah.
And fear.
Right.
My mom's boyfriend of 4 years moved out a month ago, and when he moved out, the house looks like renters were there. I mean, it's just destroyed. And I've been almost obsessive about trying to clean it up. I mean, we've gone through every closet, every drawer, everything, and gotten rid of stuff. We're painting tonight. I'm doing the carpets tomorrow. But, I mean, the house is in such poor condition, it makes me sick. I mean, this is the house I grew up in, and my mom has to live there. And I'm trying to figure out if that's my ego. I just couldn't imagine leaving that the way it is and it being as it should be.
Right. Okay. Good question. Because what you're talking about is basically the whole issue, excuse me, around non-resistance. And then these are the three nons that I like. Non-attachment and non-judgment. Okay, so does that mean if I have non-resistance to something, like I'm not to not resist what is going on with your mother's house would be to say, I'm not going to react negatively to this. You know, I don't have to say, this is awful, this is bad, I don't have to go into judgment about it, I can let go of my attachment that my mother lives there, and I can let go of my attachment to that it was my childhood home. Does that mean I take no action? No. That's not what that means at all. You still take the action. It's like, oh God, here comes this example again that I used. And it's the best one, isn't it? Some of you know this. If I get stuck in the mud at night in the rain, I'm not going to sit there and go, okay, I guess I'm just supposed to sit here in the mud in the rain at night. You know, that's not what non-resistance means. What non-resistance means is I'm not going to get angry. I'm not going to emotionally react to it. The ego is going to react to it. Oh, this figures. Of course it would be me. I mean, this is the story of my life. You know, all those things that we say, now I'm going to be late. No, it's like, oh, I'm stuck in the mud. Okay, what do I need to do now? Oh, I call somebody, they come help. Or I get out and I start walking. You just do the next thing. So he moves out, you notice the house is in the shape that it's in. Mom, probably in her frame of mind, can kind of see it, but she's overwhelmed by it. And so you just look at that, you notice it, and you do the next thing. But there's no energy going into the why, or judging it, or having attachment as to how it should be. You just do the next thing. You start vacuuming, and then you start painting, and then you start cleaning out cupboards and closets, and come on, Mom, let's do this room. And that's what that means, to not have resistance. If I accept what is, I'm accepting that in this moment, this is what's going on, and that I have choices. That's what free will is all about. So, and this is an area that I have trouble in, big time trouble, when I see children or animals being treated badly or abused or neglected in any way, it is a tough one for me, because I still have yet to not have any of the, I've still not gone to, I mean, my ego just jumps right in. I'm resisting it because I don't like it. They shouldn't be doing that. They need to be shot. I mean, that's just where my ego goes. You know, take them out in the backyard and shoot them. Easy. I have attachment as to what's supposed to happen and how people around are supposed to behave in that situation. And if not, what is wrong with them? Shoot them too. Not judgment. Obviously, I'm full of judgment, right? So it's all the ego. So here's the problem with that. Whenever I experience that, and because I go there, guess what? Am I operating out of any intuitive sense at all? No, absolutely not. I'm totally operating out of ego, needing to have control. My fear is up, and the way my fear shows up is through anger. So I end up really not being that helpful. Go ahead.
One of the things, but I mean, I feel the same way about kids and animals as well, but I never thought it was ego versus kids can't defend themselves.
I'm not saying I wouldn't do anything. If I don't go to a judgment, attachment, resistant place, I'm going to be more intuitive with how I respond to that situation, because I believe if I'm there, I'm supposed to be involved. I'm witnessing it. I'm supposed to step in. But if I step in with all that emotion, how am I really any different than the abuser? I'm probably yelling and screaming. Not probably. I've done it. In the grocery store. And guess what? That kid had to go home with that parent that I verbally laid out. That I abused about them being abusive. Oh, that was helpful. But if I came at it from a place of love, if I wasn't sitting in judgment about it, if I didn't have attachment as to how she should be behaving or he should be behaving, then I'm going to be much more intuitive and much more able to respond rather than react. And to me, that's what responsibility is the ability to respond. Laura? You're welcome, Matt.
Okay, Karen. So I made a little note here. Love or fear, I think you were talking a little while ago when you first listened. I can't really read it very well, but it says something about, is ego produced? You want to talk a little bit about love? Because you just,
yeah, because under love, what we really have is our spirit, our I am presence, our soul, whatever, our awareness. If you want to call it awareness, if you're more comfortable with those terms, that's fine. This is ego. In Marshall Rosenberg terms, this would be giraffe, because he's the one that came up with nonviolent communication. And so he talks about how we need to learn how to speak giraffe and how to listen with giraffe ears, because we all talk jackal and listen with jackal ears, which means all of this stuff. I'm full of judgment, I have attachment, which is expectations, and I'm in resistance. If I don't like something, if I'm saying something isn't okay, this is wrong, this is bad, this shouldn't be this way. Okay? So, love is real. This is the illusion. and, you know, another acronym for this, just like there was for denial, false evidence appearing real. Most of what we're afraid of is not real, and not only that, if you, you know, I take it all the way to the, since this is all spiritual for me, I'm looking at how even if I am faced with someone killing me, let's say, okay, somebody's got a gun and they're pointing it at my head, and I can see in their eyes they've got serious intent. Well, bottom line is, I don't believe that this meat suit is all there is. You know, this is the suit I showed up in this time around, and that energy will go back to source, and maybe or maybe not decide to come back to Disney Earth, go through the menu, pick out the rides. Because on that side of the veil, see, I don't believe that we even judge any of this stuff. See, we're all, on the other side of the veil, we're already in non-resistance, non-attachment, non-judgment. We don't judge any of it. We're doing it solely for the experience. But then, you know, those are my personal beliefs. So for me, love is real. And this is where joy comes from. This is where listening openly, asking somebody to clarify, you know, which is all about what nonviolent communication is about. It's about questioning my thoughts so that I get out of resistance, attachment, and judgment, which keeps me in fear. And fear usually manifests itself in all kinds of other ways. Anxiety, you know how you're working on something on your computer and you're done with it, but you don't really work. You're not really done with it, but you need it out of the way, so you hit the little minimize thing and it drops down and you're not seeing it. Or even better yet, those programs that are running in the background of the computer that keeps everything doing what it's supposed to do, but you don't even see them. That's what, to me, that anxiety is doing. It's going on all the time. All the time. And the ego plays on that. The ego's food, the ego's way to stay fed and to be energized and charged up is all through disagreements, having judgments, getting pissed off, being fearful, going into all the little dramas that we play, being the victim, because even men can be damsels in distress, and being the dragon, and women can be the dragon. And, you know, that triangle of the persecutor, the victim, and the rescuer. Well, I've always seen them as the damsel in distress, the dragon, and the white knight. But, you know, I mean, all of that stuff is coming out of there. Does that answer that, Corey, a little better?
How do you stay in love?
Well, it's about staying in presence. Yeah. Well, it's about always pulling yourself back into right now. One of the things that I have people do that I say, you have to practice it. As soon as you have awareness, because you're not going to have the awareness when you're out of it. You just won't. Especially if you haven't practiced this. It's like practicing anything else. If you're going to learn how to, if you're going to sit down and play Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven, you've never taken a piano lesson in your life and you're not a prodigy, you don't have to start by taking lessons, and then you start practicing, right? You're practicing scales. You're not even looking at the music yet. That's maybe a year or two down the road. But enough practice, and eventually you get there, right? It's the same with this. The way you get present is you have to get disciplined. We have to be disciplined about this. So every time you get the awareness, oh, I really haven't been fully present. And what I will say every time, like right now, I would say, I'm a woman standing. In my living room, I'm a woman sitting on a couch. And I just focus in on what it feels like to sit on that couch, or right now what it feels like to stand right here on this carpet. Be right here, right now. Feel your body. Many times in here, what I'll have people do is practice just feeling the aliveness in your hands. Experience the energy in your hands. And if you do that, you've gotten into present moment. but it takes practice. And what we don't have is discipline. I used to volunteer at our house over in Portland. It was an AIDS hospice center. And most of the people that were there were smoking. And I knew if I went up to them and said, here's a cure for AIDS, and here's a cigarette, what do you want? And because we have no spiritual discipline, as much as their spirit would desperately want this and say, yes, let's do this, they'd probably pick the cigarette. And that's a real extreme example, but each one of us does this every day. Every day. Stop and think about the next time you go to turn on the radio or turn on the television or sit down at the internet, and you don't really need to. Oh, the ego's telling you, oh yeah, I need to check my email. No, you don't, probably. Try disciplining yourself. Put it off for 15 minutes and just sit for 15 minutes and watch what a struggle it is. It's no different than those folks choosing between the cure for AIDS and a cigarette. It's no different. We do not have spiritual discipline. It's one of the hardest things for me to do. I'm getting much better at it. I've slowly, over the years, been able, and that's why I'm talking practice, because it takes consistency, it takes repetition. The way we learn best is repetition. You know, so a lot of times my stuff, I know I sound like a broken record, but it's what works for me, and it's what works for most people. Because it's about, and the ego will go, oh yeah, I'm bored with that, come on. Really? Come on, can we pick up the pace, Karen? Yeah, no, not so much. And I've had people tell me that they've come to this class and they email me and let me know, well, the class really isn't for me because it just, for one thing, it didn't make any sense, and I don't know how you can really apply that to the real world, and the rest of us have to live in the real world. And I just said, okay, because they're not there, and it's all right that they're not. But they certainly wouldn't be able to discipline themselves spiritually. But that's what it requires. The willingness to say no to the ego and say, okay, I'm a woman standing. I'm a woman sitting. Try it tonight when you go to bed. Do a lot of you have trouble getting this to get quiet when you're going to sleep? When you turn off the light and you lay your head on the pillow, I want you to just start saying, I'm a woman or I'm a man lying in bed. I'm a woman or I'm a man lying in bed. And then I want you to feel the sheets, the weight of the blankets, the mattress under your body, how it's supporting you, that you have this safe place to sleep. And repeat that. You'd be amazed. But if you remember to try that tonight, tomorrow night, the next night, before next circle, email me and let me know what your experience was. I'd love to hear from you about it. Because it's really a trip how it changes. Okay. Carrie, you had a question?
I wonder. Well,
hang on a minute, please, for my other students.
As you were talking, I was thinking about how much easier it is to kind of keep this stuff in mind throughout the day. When, you know, I meditate or I take a moment, I write my journal, whatever. I mean, I have to almost put it in a seat. Mm-hmm. But Katie puts it as though, you know, reminds us that it's not going to go away. I'm not going to stop having these thoughts and feelings, mm-hmm. but I can start to not invest in them, to go, oh, isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. Like a cloud.
Just notice.
And I found as I practice, it really does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Help so much that, you know, I'm still having a hard time with this ego thing. You know, I'm working on it. And the author with the spirit, the giraffe and the jackal?
Marshall Rosenberg.
I was looking for some of his stuff. Anyway, I just thought I'd share. It does get easier with practice. I mean, practice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like practice with anything.
And trying not to get over invested when those little thoughts come.
Right, because
so sneaky.
Well, the thing is if you jump in and start getting pissed off about having the thoughts, that's just the other voice of the ego.
Mm-hmm.
The ego will grab onto any identity, any position. It will judge the hell out of you. It doesn't care who it judges. It'll beat you up. Ever feel like you were just beating yourself up between your ears all day long over something? That was just the ego. It just found another way to survive. So, yeah. So when those thoughts come in, I just see them as sort of errant children. I kind of giggle and go, oh, okay. want some milk and cookies?
I don't know where we're at. I'm still struggling
about
what to do with this ego. I kind of, you know, just...
You don't do anything with the ego.
Just
you don't do anything with the ego. You discipline yourself to get into present moment because the ego does not exist in present moment. So if I decide I'm going to figure out a way to take care of the ego, I'm now in resistance. It's just another mask that the ego has put on. It's going to go up against itself because it can survive. It doesn't care. It'll do anything. And you can't. So all you have to do is just go, oh, I'm not in present moment. I'm a woman sitting in a chair.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. I like to end with this version of the Lord's Prayer. I'm not Christian, for those of you that are wondering. This is a direct translation from Aramaic to present-day English, so it's the true Lord's Prayer, and I really like it. My spiritual teacher down in Sedona actually gave it to me, and you can actually go online to find it. Just type in true Lord's Prayer from Aramaic to present-day English. O cosmic birther of all radiance and vibration, soften the ground of our being and carve out a space within us where your presence can abide. Fill us with your creativity so that we may be empowered to bear the fruit of your mission. Let each of our actions bear fruit in accordance with our desire. Endow us with the wisdom to produce and share what each being needs to grow and flourish. Untie the tangled threads of destiny that bind us as we release others from the entanglements of past mistakes. Do not let us be seduced by that which would divert us from our true purpose, but illuminate the opportunities of the present moment. For you are the ground and the fruitful vision, the birth power and fulfillment as all is gathered and made whole again. Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you, guys. Have fun with that. Let me know. Help me, will you?